I will hear argument now in the case of United States against Williams. Now we'll hear argument in United States against Williams. Mr. Alvarado.
May it please the court. Rob Alvarado, I'm an assistant federal defender from Peoria. Your Honors, I'm going to agree with the government on one point in this case, and that is that the lineup, as it was constituted, was fairly close. All six men were wearing the same Peoria County jail uniform. They were all about the same height, same race, same body build. Nothing really distinguished one from the other except for the shoes of Mr. Williams. He had white tennis shoes on. Everyone else had the... Right.
Well, is there any social science research which suggests that this kind of difference can lead to a substantial probability of irreparable misidentification? And I put it that way because what the parties have addressed in their briefs is not the constitutional issue. The Supreme Court has not said all suggestive lineups are bad. It said that a suggestive lineup is bad if it produces, and the magic language in the court's cases is, a substantial probability of irreparable misidentification. That is something a jury can't figure out and discount for. Now, that sounds like it's asking a question about what we know about the psychology of eyewitness identification and inviting somebody to go to the literature. There's now a vast literature. Have you done that? Do we know that this is the kind of thing that produces a substantial probability of irreparable misidentification?
No, Your Honor. We didn't do any social science study to determine whether that was...
Well, without it, how can one say the district judge is wrong?
Because I think you can apply common sense.
Oh, no. That's the last thing you can apply. That's the one thing the social science literature shows is a very poor guide. What people think on the basis of common sense about eyewitness identification is almost always wrong.
Well, then I would ask that the court apply prior precedent and look at prior precedent to see if it's similar to the instant case. In that respect, I would ask the court to consider its own ruling in United States versus Downs. In that case, there was a five-man lineup. Four had heavy mustaches, and the fifth was clean-shaven. Guess which one was Mr. Downs? That's the one that was clean-shaven. Incidentally, that happened to be the same district judge in this case who found in the Downs case that the lineup was unduly suggestive.
Look, but the what I'm saying is that that's not the legal standard. It may be that in some other cases the parties have paid no attention to the legal standard. Indeed, neither side's brief in this case pays attention to the Supreme Court's statement of the legal test. But I've now raised the question, can you meet the Supreme Court's standard in Biggers? And it sounds like you're saying, no, we have no basis to think that standard can be met.
Well, we have no social science basis to say that that standard is met. But I submit that in all the other cases in which this court and other courts have grappled with that issue, social science can't provide the answer. You have to look at the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances surrounding the identification. And in this case, what we point to are some very curious things that happened when the witness testified about those white tennis shoes.
But the fact is, even if, you know, to take a more traditional approach, even if you thought, as the district judge thought it was close on the first part of the Neal against Biggers test, that there might have been something suggestive, he wasn't even sure about that because it's not clear that at least one of the witnesses could even see the tennis shoes, much less that they attracted her attention to this man. But if you get to the ultimate question, which we all understand is where Biggers is going, in this gestalt, you know, totality of the circumstances sense, even in Downs for that matter, but in many, many cases, people say, you know, this is not a half bad lineup. It's pretty good, actually. And there's no reason to think that the ultimate reliability of the identification was compromised.
You're absolutely right. It's not a half bad lineup, but that assumes that the only process that's going through the witness's mind is a conscious one. We cannot determine what the subconscious mind did with those white tennis shoes. We cannot define that. I guess in some sense it's like tapping on the floor in a men's room stall. I mean, some people might say you're in a hurry. Other people might say it means something else.
Or waving your hand or what have you.
Well, that's what the district judge was there to determine.
If you don't have the social science research, you should have something at least that where the witness says, boy, I spotted those white tennis shoes on the lineup right away, or something about the lineup, you know, and there's nothing like that in the record.
But that would have been on a conscious level. On a subconscious level, the witness said, she gave a very detailed description of the assailants, very vivid, very descriptive.
But who has the burden of proof to show that this lineup is so tainted that the ultimate identification was unreliable?
It is our burden to show that.
Did you ever argue that in the district court? You haven't argued it in your appellate brief. Did you ever argue it in the district court?
Well, it seemed to me that it was clear that it was our burden to show that. We were certainly...
No, what you seem to think is that it's your burden to show that the lineup was unduly suggestive. I'm asking, did you ever argue the second part of the Neal against Biggers requirement in the district court? That is, a substantial probability of irreparable misidentification. Or did you just conflate the two as if they were one standard?
Well, we conflated the two, but we argued that the witness clearly said things on the stand under oath that showed a drastic inconsistency with what the lineup showed. And that was this. The witness was very...
Whoa. You're now undermining your position. If you can show a problem on the stand, then you don't have a substantial probability of irreparable misidentification. You have the kind of thing that can be detected and exposed.
Well, that's true in one sense, but the point is this. The witness said that she did not see any white tennis shoes, period. She was very adamant about that, even though she was very descriptive about everything else about both of the assailants that were in the diner. She was contradicted by the police officer who said she very clearly said he was wearing white tennis shoes. Now, somebody wasn't telling the truth about that. Somebody was inaccurate. I'm not even going to say that somebody was lying. Somebody was inaccurate. And it seems to me that the only explanation is that the subconscious mind was at work here. She saw those white tennis shoes, but she did not repeat that under oath at the hearing for whatever reason. And then when she looked at the lineup, she testified that she got right up to the glass in a position where she could see the shoes if she chose to look down, even glance down. You can't help but miss seeing those shoes. But the officer who conducted the lineup and whose job it is to be very clear about what happened at these things said she didn't get any closer than 10 feet, so she couldn't have seen the shoes. Now, somebody's not telling the truth again. Nobody's lying, but somehow you have to reconcile those facts. Judge Mim did not clearly say what he believed to be the truth in those two instances. He said there were some inconsistencies, but he said those weren't enough to find that the lineup was unduly suggestive. I would submit that the lineup was unduly suggestive simply because there was one clear, dramatic difference, as Judge Mim put it, that stood out from all the others.
It seems that you would have a much better case here if there was a unanimity of by the eyewitnesses, and one eyewitness saw the same lineup and was unable to make an identification.
That's right, but that witness did not testify at the suppression hearing, so we don't know why
we know that a witness, there were three witnesses here.
Well, there were actually four.
Lutke was the one of the key people involved in this incident, and she was unable to identify.
Identified the defendant by voice on a level of certainty of 5 to 6, I believe, on a scale of 10.
But see, it seems to me, not to put too much weight in common sense, but if the same people viewed the same lineup and at least one of them couldn't make an identification, that doesn't tell me that that lineup was unduly suggestive.
You're right, except that one person did not testify at the suppression hearing, so we don't know why that person couldn't make an identification. Maybe that witness didn't want to make an identification.
Ordinarily, you don't have a witness who doesn't make an identification testify at a suppression hearing.
Right, but the simple fact is that we don't know why that witness did not make an identification, and there could be lots of reasons other than the fact that she saw the same lineup and was not subconsciously influenced by the white tennis shoes. That's my point. And, Your Honor, my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Alvarado. Ms. Mullen.
May it please the Court, my name is Linda Mullen, and I represent the United States. I was feeling really great about our brief this morning until I heard your comments, Judge Easterbrook. I think I understand what you're saying when you say that they didn't appropriately focus on this standard of substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification.
There are two. The substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification, according to the Supreme Court, is the basis for suppression. The court also concluded in Neal that unless the lineup is unduly suggestive, we don't have to worry about irreparable misidentification. That is something that can't be explained to a jury, that cannot be adequately ventilated at trial. But when the parties to the appeal, and apparently in the district court, focus only on the precondition and then never ask the only constitutionally relevant question, it's very hard to see how the case can be decided accurately.
Well, if I may, I think that the district court...
It would be like an antitrust case where proof of market power is a precondition to analysis under the rule of reason. And if the defendant has market power, then you conduct the rule of reason analysis. And we have a case in which the only question that gets asked in the district court is whether there was market power, and nobody ever runs the rule of reason analysis. You couldn't answer the case correctly.
While the point may not be adequately articulated in the briefs, I do think that the district court focused on this issue of whether or not there was a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. And I think in doing that, the district court said, look, we've got the difference in color in the tennis shoes, but if we look at the lineup as a whole and we look at the procedures that were employed here, I'm not as concerned about that as I might have been in another case. So a difference in clothing can make a difference.
And how does the district court decide that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How does the district court know? Right. Everybody would agree that if this were a dispute about the etiology of a disease, you would need to get some medical evidence. You wouldn't just ask the district court to look inside his noggin. But we've got the same problem here. What happens inside people's heads, how they process information in a way that leads to eyewitness identification, is a subject of a huge literature. It's not something one gets by intuiting.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I can tell you that our office has been, I can't say responsive, but I think is becoming more aware of the comments from the bench about needing that kind of evidence in all of our suppression hearings.
Not simply needing it. We held in United States against Brown that without it, a motion to suppress ought not be granted. By the way, both parties have ignored Brown on this appeal, too.
But I might add, just to bail you out slightly, that that if you look at the district, at least as I read the district court's comments, he seems first to address the question whether this was an unduly suggestive lineup, that precondition question. And he concludes at page 102 of the transcript that he doesn't think it's unduly suggestive. And then he goes on and says, even if I had found that, I want to go on quickly to say that in looking at the five factors, I think what he's trying to say is I am going on now, even if it was suggestive, to see if the ultimate question needs to be answered in a way. And he rolls through in a couple of pages. It reminds me of an earlier case we had this morning. It's not an enormously long discussion, but he does roll through the factors. And at the end, he says, I believe even if the court had found the lineup was unduly suggestive, each of the two witnesses who made a positive identification had an adequate opportunity blah, 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 that would make the identification reliable. So he seems finally to say it's a reliable identification.
I think you're right, Judge Wood. I think he clearly did go on to address the five Biggers factors and said that even though I'm finding that the lineup was not unduly suggestive, I'm going to go ahead and make those additional findings and canvass those factors. And I think when we look at those five factors, the record clearly supports the district court's finding in that regard. First of all, the witnesses had ample opportunity over a relatively long period of time in this situation. The Downs case, by contrast, the robbery was 50 seconds. Here we have a 10 to 15 minute long robbery in relatively close quarters in a well-lit restaurant in the middle of the day. And the defendant and his cohort had just been in the restaurant as customers prior to the robbery. So the eyewitnesses also had the opportunity, when they weren't stressed, when they didn't have this heightened level of anxiety and fear, to encounter the defendant and his cohort and have conversation with them when they were customers. In fact, I think one of the witnesses says she made a point to make eye contact with people who were entering the restaurant, and one of the witnesses, Fisher, was actually waiting on the defendant and his accomplice. With respect to the level of attention paid, the second Biggers factor, the court found that certainly once the guns came out, the witnesses had every reason to attend to the people in the room, and they were continuing to converse with the defendant and his accomplice throughout the robbery. There was conversation going on. One of the witnesses was begging the defendant to leave the purses behind because her friend had a heart condition. The defendant was issuing orders. They were talking back and forth during that 10 to 15 minute time. With respect to the accuracy of the description at the scene, the only testimony elicited on that point was with respect to Cynthia Edwards and what she said at the scene. There was some discrepancy between what she said at the suppression hearing and what the detective remembered her saying at the scene, but the district court said that that description was fairly accurate. I think it was within a couple of inches of his actual height. And in terms of the time frame between the robbery and the lineup, it was a mere 6 hours. And at the lineup, the witnesses who did identify the defendant had a high level of certainty and identified the defendant almost immediately, so that they had 99.9%.
You do realize that that's the one thing the social science literature tells you is utterly unreliable. The degree of certitude bears no relation whatsoever to the accuracy of an eyewitness identification. Both you and the district court seem to have placed a lot of reliance on that. Well, but it's the one thing we know is not a good basis for decision.
I don't think that the district court placed heavy reliance on that. I think the district court looked at the five Biggers factors that have been outlined by the Supreme Court and canvassed each of those factors.
If you had read Brown, you would have known that we have said that those five factors are not legal standards. They were what the Supreme Court thought the social science literature as of 30 years ago was saying. But we have learned things since then, and those are no longer the right criteria to be looking at. That's what we said in Brown.
I will definitely take the comments from the bench back to our office, and again, we are aware that the court is becoming increasingly frustrated with the lack of evidence on these points at suppression hearings, and that we are relying too much on testimony and not on studies that have been done and empirical evidence that's out there. So obviously the movement in our office isn't as quick as it should be and as thorough as it should be. We in our small appellate division in our office do the best that we can to take back the comments that we hear in other oral arguments and certainly in the opinions, and hope, and this will serve as a nice springboard, I think, to further emphasize to the assistants that we need to start focusing on this kind of evidence. Unfortunately, in this case, we have the record that we have. And I think, fortunately, the district court did at least follow the test based upon the evidence before it. And when we look at those five Biggers factors that the court did canvass and rule on, it's pretty clear in this case that there was not a substantial likelihood of a misidentification here. And for those reasons, we would ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.